Our great thanks to you, Devaki, and to your son for having set in motion the Devaki Jain Lectures, which have been a forum for bringing women from the Global South to talk about the issues that concern us all about the empowerment of women and the empowerment of the Global South against the economic and the political challenges posed by the domination of the Northern Hemisphere. And we have had, through your kind auspices, five outstanding lecturers associated with your name. It is with some happiness we welcome the lecture to St. Antony's, particular happiness to have a speaker from the Arab world and the Middle East, and to be welcoming our distinguished fifth Devaki Jain lecturer, Rana Hosseini. I would just like to note that this is the final Devaki Jain lecture. And so that is a grounds for some regret, because we know that these lectures in the four previous iterations at St. Anne's College have been a source of light to the conversation here in Oxford. And we always hate to see the lights go out. So should there be the opportunity to extend the life of the Devaki Jain lectures, you'll have all of us in the audience today advocating for that actively. But for what you brought to us, we wish to say we're very grateful, and we are excited to be continuing this tradition tonight. We just wish that instead of talking to you on Zoom from Delhi, we would be having you with us in person in Oxford. And we hope to have that pleasure in the very near future again. So thank you, Devaki. And I would now like to take a moment to introduce our speaker tonight. And it's a particular pleasure to be welcoming to Oxford and to the Middle East Center as the fifth Devaki Jain lecturer, Rana Hosseini. Dr. Hosseini is a Jordanian human rights activist and a senior journalist who has been writing for Jordanian press, most notably the Jordan Times. She's focused on social issues over the last 25 years, with a special interest on violence against women, as well as the brutal crimes that are committed against Jordanian women in the name of family honor. And no one likes to pair the word honor with murder, because they are so incompatible with each other. And I think no one has been more vocal and outspoken in combating this notion, so deeply entrenched in Jordanian society, as honor killing. So I think we have Rana to thank for having led the struggle on this most enduringly through the books that she has written, her 2009 classic Murder in the Name of Honor is already on the track to setting the record right on how dishonorable such violence is. And then most recently, her 2021 Years of Struggle, The Women's Movement in Jordan. We will hear from Rana tonight, drawing on these themes, and I hope you will all join me in extending the warmest of welcomes to Rana Hosseini.
Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for coming. Thank you, Dr. Devaki, for inviting me to be part of this important event to seal the program, which I hope it will be reborn again, and you will have more lectures coming. Thanks to everyone at Antony's
here, Anne's there, but either one, I don't care.
Thanks for everyone who really helped me come here and be part of this lecture. I will talk in two things, because first of all, I'll talk a bit about myself, and then I want to also share with you, the path of the Jordanian women's movement, because I think, hasn't it been for these women who fought and worked hard, I wouldn't probably be here. Mm. So you always have to acknowledge and respect people before you. And I brought with me, I ordered actually this book, my first book, Murder in the Name of Honor. It was published here in Oxford. I used the British publishing house because I felt they were serious. They will not play with the theme itself. And so I ordered some books. Please feel free to have some. And this is my recent book, which I carried with me. Take with you. So I'm joking. so that the bag will not be, no, I'm joking. So yeah, so most of the presentation will be part of, you know, it's part of what's in this book and a bit more. But since Ms. Devaki said she wanted to hear more about me as a feminist and how I started my journey in Jordan, I studied in the USA, but before that, I was in Jordan, I was an athlete, I played basketball, and that's in the 80s. Yes, I was. I played for 20 years and I was the captain of the national team. And back then, I always felt discriminated against. I'm talking in the 80s, like the men would get everything, your clothes, shoes, they will get to travel, they will get to train. And we would beg them to, you know, organize something for us. So when I went to study in the US, I always wanted to come back and do something, because there was also discrimination against women in the laws, many laws, you know. But the issue of so-called honor crimes, which is the book, the first book I wrote, was never in my head. I never experienced such violence or knew anyone who experienced such violence around me. We would read about the story here and there when we were young, but so for me, I always wanted to go back and do something for women in Jordan. I wanted to change the laws, you know, like you now, you all want to change the world with your age. You want to do a lot of things, and now with social media, it's even a different ball game. So when I returned to Jordan, I wanted to work for the Jordan Times. I said I will cover anything, whatever they give me, I will cover, and then I will find my way to my cause. But, so they assigned me as the crime reporter. I don't know, is it my height? I don't know what. So I said, okay, crime. I'll start reporting crime, so what? That was in 93. So I started coming across murders, including so-called honor killings. Mm. Started reporting about women who are killed. And then there was a very sad story that happened in June or May of 1994, which was a girl who was 16. She was killed by one of her brothers because another brother raped her. So they basically blamed her for the rape. Now, this is not a daily occurrence in Jordan, but this was the story that made me do everything I'm doing until this day, which is this girl was a victim 6 times. Her brother put sleeping pills for her. He raped her. Then he threatened to kill her if she tells her family. She became pregnant. She had to tell them. He tried to kill her. She survived. And then they married her off to a man who's 34 years older than her. She had a secret abortion. Imagine all these horrific details. She's only 16. So I reported the story for the Jordan Times, and the following day, a woman called the newspaper, and instead of encouraging me, she was screaming and yelling at my editors that they should stop me from reporting about these crimes because this is not us or our society. So I became even more enraged that a call came from instead of thanking me. And at that time, really, the press wasn't reporting about such cases. Even violence against women was not accepted. Not in Jordan, not in the region, by the way. It was very hard for you to open a newspaper. Now I'm talking newspaper, which now for you is obsolete. But it was to open a newspaper and read, like a violence. Again, it was like taboo. Nobody. So what about so-called honor killings? It was double taboo, triple taboo. So because I worked in the Jordan Times, we had more flexibility. It was in English, it was a certain readers. So I got enraged. I said, I want to show her and show everyone that else that, no, this is not us, this is our society. We need to do something about it. So I started to report each and every case I heard about. Our readers, the Jordan Times, are the decision makers, the royal family, the government, the intellectuals, people who are learning English. So it's not a big audience. But I said I wanted to report somewhere that these women were killed and someone was getting away with it also. They were getting away with murder, 3 months, 6 months. So that was my focus in the beginning, and I was like documenting. I said I want to document, to put that this woman lived on this earth and she's no longer with us. So I started winning awards. I never aimed for awards, you know. So as you see, the topic came to me. I didn't go. So this is how I started my work. Back then, it was, we did have female journalists who were crime reporters, but because a lot of people would ask me, is it easy for you, you know, to be a female and write about crimes? And it was okay. I mean, it wasn't that bad. In the beginning, of course, as any journalist, I don't know if any of you are studying journalism, it's hard to you need to work on establishing sources and so forth to have to gain their confidence and so forth. And of course, there was a lot of people who were against me. If you want to talk about the feminist angle, there was a lot of people who were like this crazy radical feminist who is want to destroy the morals of our society, who wants to expose us. Although I never identified myself as a feminist, but still people labeled me, and they labeled me as a Western agent. There were all kinds of labeling happening until this day, by the way, and in my presentation I'll tell you more about it, how they label the women's movement. I thought in the beginning it was only in Jordan, but when I started to go and see other activists worldwide, by the way, it's not only in our region, they're always labeled Western Zionists. Western agents, Zionist agents. I get paid to write. I mean, really, I don't need anyone to tell me what's right and what's wrong. I have a brain, I can think to myself. So this was the beginning of my work. This was basically one of the first bumps in my life. And then back then also people were telling me, what are you doing? You're wasting your time. You write in English. Nothing will ever change in this country. You don't reach a wide audience. You're wasting your time. But I said, no, I kept going on. I felt that I needed to report about these crimes. You know, I wanted to be persistent, to be consistent, to nag. Basically, I wanted to nag our readers, and we succeeded in nagging them. After I won my second award, which is the Reebok Human Rights Award, I discovered that I was also a human rights activist. I'm not only a journalist. So then I had two things to carry with me. I'm like, oh, okay, I'm not just a reporter. So the responsibility grew. When I came back to Jordan after winning this award, a group of young men and women approached me and said, let's do something on the grassroots level. So we formed a committee, and we were meeting at houses. We didn't have an NGO or anything, and we were sitting and strategizing what we need to do and all of that. So we decided to write a petition and have people sign it, and we went out to governorates telling them about these crimes. And this was something very important because it really broke a lot of social taboos. Mm-hmm. The media, of course, started to write about us, some of us slandering us, accusing us of being Western agents, others thanking us. So this is when we broke the silence around this topic forever. Also, the women's movement after that started to do their own activities. So it became all a national movement. Of course, the petition we gave it to the parliament that we want to cancel the laws that offers leniency to killers. They didn't listen to us. On the contrary, they trashed us in the parliament. They trashed women of Jordan in the parliament back then. But eventually things changed, but several laws changed. A lot of things have changed. I will talk more about it in the presentation. So this is basically, I would say, my struggle as a journalist, which basically, it was a struggle in terms of not me being a woman. I think it's the topic itself. It was a very hard topic. It was a challenging and daring topic. It was, people were, you know, sometimes asking me, are you afraid for your life? I got some threats. People, you know, threatened me, you know, if I didn't stop from reporting, but I didn't listen to anyone. I said, you know, I'll just keep going because I'm not harming anyone. I'm not doing anything wrong. On the contrary, it's defending someone's life is something noble, I think. So I ended, here I am today talking to you. And when I wrote this book, of course, it took me 5 years. It took me 10 years between finding a publisher. Because, you know, most people want someone to come and curse. Since we are here in the Middle East section, so maybe you understand me more. They look more for someone who is coming to curse the Middle East or Arabs or Muslims or whatever, or trying to say that this is a Muslim thing. And from the beginning, I told, you know, I found an agent here, and I told the agent, listen, I want a publisher that is not gonna try to enforce such ideologies in the book, because I'm not hiding anything, but there is crimes. They happen everywhere. They happen among all religions and classes in several countries, not only in Jordan. Eventually, I found One World, which is here in Oxford. Mm. And also, I told them before I signed the contract, I told them, I have a condition. I will not accept a cover that has a covered woman or a man with a beard or someone standing next to a mosque or whatever, you know. So they accepted, and in the beginning they didn't know how to do the cover. It for them, it was they had difficulty, and then they brought a professional person, and then they came up with this cover, which is very expressive as well. So when I wrote this book, I said, there's no way on earth. I mean, it's like doing a PhD. It's like crazy. 5 years, it's a nightmare to write the book. And, you know, the editing process and all that. I said, no way, that's it. I'm never writing a book again in my life. But never say never. Fast forward 10 years later, in 2019, I decided, hey, why don't I? Because of my work, I noticed that there's not a lot of resources for women in Jordan. It's all scattered, it's incomplete, or someone would write from their own perspective. They would put some and leave everyone else. I got a lot of emails from students, mainly from researchers. Everybody wants to know something. And I would sit and spend hours answering them, because as an activist, I felt this is my duty to help students. So I said, why not gather everything in a book and make it free? This one is on Amazon, but for you it's free. I order it. But I said, because I know when I was a student, you know, you want the money for something else. Nobody wants to pay for books. Now you're lucky because you have the internet and all that. You can get everything free, almost. But anyway, during our time we had to pay. So I said, I'll combine everything in a book. And it's available free as a hard copy and online. So you can find it PDF. And the idea was, I interviewed 35 Jordanian men and women. I did use 98% of the references are from Jordanian men and women, be it researchers, papers, articles, whatever. So because I wanted it to be our story, told from Jordanian men and women to their peers. So this is the idea, and for free, because I believe that no one should pay to pay money to read their history, especially women's history as well. So I went to Friedrich Ebert Stifting, which is a German organization, and because they are the ones who always support these things, and they liked the idea, and I got a very small support, and I wrote the book during the corona time, when we were locked up, and when we were able to go out, I would go jump and interview someone and then come back. It was, yeah, but I mean, and also I also did a lot of articles. I used a lot of my articles because I've been a reporter for 30 years now, covering women's issues. So I know a lot about the what has been happening, especially the last 20 years. So my idea was, I was gonna call it 20 years because I was focusing on the last 20 years. But then the Friedrich Ebert said, no, hey, it looks better if you drop the 20. So we dropped the 20 since I started in the 40s. So I started in the 40s. I depended on five major female researchers, doctors, they're all doctors. And they started in the 40s, documenting the women's movement in the 40s, when they started to work as a group. We did have some individual women who worked in the before, but it was not visible. So in the 40s, you know, basically women's role was very limited in Jordan. They didn't do a lot of, you know, activities back then. So yeah, in the 40s, women were sort of excluded. They didn't have, you know, a lot of say back then. Elections, of course, is something very important. We have a parliament in Jordan. Women were not allowed to vote or run for elections. It only men could vote back then. The first women association in Jordan was established under the name Social Solidarity Society by a group of school teachers. Imagine, these are, it was charitable, of course. And the honorary president was Queen Masbah, which is the first queen of Jordan. In 1944, women's group went and took part in the first Arab women's meeting. You know why? Do you know why I'm telling you this? Because this was something rare. I mean, it was a big deal for women to travel alone back then. I'm sure it, you know, similarly here, it was very hard to, but nevertheless, they did go and they did meet women from other countries as well. Their demands, I want to tell you, their demands back then were more progressive than now. There are some things I will tell you that now the women's movement cannot call for. Achieve economic independence back in the 40s, equal pay, and end polygamy. Now, if you call in Jordan for ending polygamy, you will go to jail. or you know, you will be an outcast. Amend the personal status law. Grant working women full 6-week maternity leave. Now it's they finally got it until 90. And address articles that openly discriminate against women. This was really back then. It's big deal. You know, in the 40s, we're talking about, you know, women didn't have a say in anything. There were two women, Egyptian women, who really affected the women's movement in Jordan, which is Huda Sharawi, who was a well-known activist, and Amina Saeed, who is a journalist. They came to Jordan and they convinced King Abdullah to, the first, now King Abdullah II, to form a union for the women, and he agreed, so they opened the Women's Union Society. The union was headed by the Queen Zain. By then, Queen Misbah was gone, now we have Queen Zain. Again, increase women's education, improve children's health. You see, they were more subtle about their demands. Now the 50s, I would always say the 50s in Jordan for me are the golden times, because back then it was mostly political parties, the Nasserism time, communist, nationalist. It was a different era back then in Jordan. And everyone was working for everything. Everyone was working for everything. I mean, it's not like our women are only working for women's causes. Even men were also working for women's causes. This is a photo in the 50s. Look at the women. The women are in the front in Jordan. They're leading the protest in the 50s. Now, the Communist Party back then had a big role in Jordan, and they were supporting women's rights, and they established a branch which is for to defend the women's rights, fight for the liberation of women. You see, this was all like very, very progressive and advanced. Their demands, full equality for women in everything, raise women's awareness to get involved in nationalistic and political activities, participate in demonstrations, and they did participate a lot. Another important thing was the establishment of the Young Women's Christian Association. I'm sure you all know about it. It still exists until today, but it was also an important NGO for women that still does charity work until this day and do a lot of activities, not only charity. Now, this woman is the first female lawyer in Jordan, and she was the first woman to head this important Arab Women Federation, and they were doing a lot of activities. Her name is Emily Bsharat. You know, they were going out to the streets, they were doing all kinds of things. Their demands, equal citizenship rights, you know, I don't want to read because you can read, but why do I put their demands? I want to show you why I'm putting their demands, to show you how progressive they are, and to show that their demands were before the CEDAW, the Convention on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women. Because one of the attacks that the women movement keep having in Jordan and in the Arab world is that, oh, you're all following CEDAW, CEDAW is calling for gay rights. Of course, there's nothing about it, but they keep, you know, creating all these things to deviate from the real problem. But see how feminists were progressive back then, and the women's movement. They also sent a memo in 1954. They sent a memo to the government, asking them to give them the right to vote. They said, you know, no, the women couldn't vote. Illiterate men could vote, women could not. I mean, this was a big deal back then. It took them some time. They also prepared a petition that was fingerprinted by women also, asking for their right to vote. So this was also, look at their activities. It was really, really important time. I mean, very organized. They were all, you know, united. It was very important. They sent a telegram to the late King Hussein, another thing they did. And back then, you know, people didn't dare to send something to the king or address. But they nevertheless, they did, and they sent this telegram, and it was also a big deal. But unfortunately, in 1957, there was an attempted coup on the life of the late King Hussein, and they banned all activities, all NGOs, except the Muslim Brotherhood. They were the only ones who stayed in the scene, and everyone else was banned. They were harassed, they were imprisoned, they were kicked out of their work. If their children, they would have been harassed, they couldn't leave the country. It was a really, but nevertheless, they still worked underground. Now the 60s, The women's movement were influenced by the Palestinians now. In the 50s, 40s, Egyptians, now Palestinians, they were united because it's Jordan and Palestine. It's considered back then like one country, one family. And women's groups started travel to raise awareness about the Palestinian cause. You know, after the first war in 48, they were always focusing, trying to help, helping the refugees. They demonstrated against the Israeli occupation of Palestine. You know, they were always in the streets, but in one way. They couldn't do many activities. It was only, okay, if you want to talk about that, okay, if you want to help refugees, go for it, but nothing else. In the meantime, the Muslim Brotherhood strengthened its presence. They infiltrated the network, schools, colleges, healthcare. They were everywhere. They were doing all kinds of activities. They were given the green light by the government to do whatever they want. The thing is also in 1967, when the war, when Jordan and everyone lost the war, it was a disaster for everyone. This is where the women's movement also started to work more on refugees. And that's why the 60s, we didn't see a lot of activities for women, because it was mainly, first of all, they were banned from working, but then if they work, it was only for refugees and so forth. Now the 70s, they continued to give services to refugees and so forth. There were some NGOs that were allowed to work, but it was also limited. Now, I think that in 1975, which is the first UN Women Conference in Mexico, I think this was a turning point for women in Jordan and every woman in the world. It was the first time that all women in the world met in a UN activity. It was a big deal for women worldwide. Now, in 1974, a year before, the women's groups went to the government and told them, listen, there's going to be an index in this conference. And it's a shame in the index to see that all women can vote and run for elections, and in Jordan they cannot. So they convinced the government, they convinced the king, and they were allowed to vote. So this is when 20 years, it took them 20 years. So they were granted the right to vote and run for parliamentary elections in 1974. It took them 20 years. There's a lot of things that took 20 years in Jordan. We'll talk about it later. Now, some achievements. We had the first woman ambassador in 1970. She didn't serve anywhere as an ambassador, but she was called an ambassador, which is important. And we had the first woman who was appointed as Minister of Social Development in 1979. These were breakthroughs because before that, we didn't see women in decision-making positions anywhere. So now in 79, keep that in mind. In the 80s, the professors that I studied and to write the book, they talked about something called NGOization. So we moved from movements into NGOs. Now we have a structure, strategies, you know, all just working on programs. So there was a shift in their work. The first time in 1984 was the time when women first cast their ballots. In 84, there was a by-elections in the parliament. Some 16 members died or changed or whatever. So there were these elections internally, and women were able to vote, but not to run. They were able to run, but nobody at that time ran for elections. The turning point from Jordan when they were able to participate in elections was in 1989. We had 12 women who ran for elections. That was a big number in 89. It was a big deal. Unfortunately, none of them won. The reasons were a patriarchal and tribal system, weak political parties, religious movement that rejected women's participation. They were fought by the religious movements and the media. Meanwhile, the Muslim Brotherhood continued to dominate the scene. We had Syrians who escaped from the first Assad's regime because there was a massacre in some two cities. So they came, they were selling their tapes, they're distributing their own kind of material, and they were allowed to do that. You know, this was something important. Now we move to the 90s. I think the 90s was some people tell me, but the 90s, which is when I started a journalist, I should be saying that it was the golden time then. But I think I still believe the 50s was the best. But the 90s, really, a lot of things changed in the 90s. First of all, establishment of Jordanian National Commission for Women, headed by Princess Basma bin Talal, who is the sister of King Hussein. The commission's mandate, you know, they worked on many activities related to women, doing the strategies and the economic empowerment, as you see in the screen. Now, in 1993, it was the history was made in Jordan with the first woman winning finally in the elections. Because in 89, the 12 women failed, only three women ran in 93, but this woman, Tujan Faisal, won, was the first woman to win in direct elections. Of course, she was fought before the elections. It was, there's a big story, they, you know, she was in a TV program and they accused her of of calling for women to marry for men, which is not true. And there was a big deal. And then, you know, it was, she was going to prison and all of that. And then after that, she still got in trouble and she went to prison after. Anyway, later on in life, it was, it's all in the book. I really think she's an amazing woman. And she suffered a lot because of her ideas. In 93, King Hussein appointed Dr. Rima Khalaf as the first female minister to serve as the trade and industry. This was a very important post, because in the past they would say, oh, you put women in minimal ministries like culture, social development, whatever, all that. So she was the first to handle this. And then she was the minister of planning, Ministry of Planning. And Ministry of Planning is very important. It's like the ministry that runs all the projects and activities in Jordan. In 1999, she was appointed as Deputy Prime Minister, the first woman until now and the last. We didn't have a female Deputy Prime Minister. It was when King Abdullah took over, she was appointed. In 1994, of course, because women were not able to run, to win in the parliament, and because of the one person, one vote system back then, it was very hard. People were always, as I saw before, they were always preferring to elect a man. Because, oh, I want a man from my clan, I want a man to do this. If something happens, who's going to go to pay a condolences? It's a man's job. They always think of these things that are trivial, you know, because the deputies shouldn't be doing all this. But this is how the society was thinking back then. So Princess Basma's idea was that, let's put women in the city councils so that people become accustomed to dealing with them, because they have to deal with them in the councils, in the governorates. They have to do, go do you know, certain things. And this way that they start to get accustomed that women are there in the governments doing things. And 99 women were appointed. This was an important move. Also in 95, there were the establishment of the Jordanian National Forum for Women. They also had branches everywhere in Jordan, and they also contributed to increasing the number of women running in the city councils. In 1995, of course, we started, this is when I started to report about violence against women, gender-based violence, about so-called honor killings. The women's movement, the Jordanian women's movement, launched the first hotline in Jordan. This was in 1995. It was an important hotline, and they started to discover that women have no place to go to. It's not like here in Europe and the West and the US, women can relocate. It's very hard in our area to, for women to relocate, because if anyone sees her, everyone donates information. People sometimes interfere in people's lives, or if she goes back, simply they would kill her, or she would be harmed. So they started with the hotlines, and then they discovered that they needed shelters for that. So this came 3 years later. In the meantime, in 1996, the first female judge was appointed in Jordan. Before that, all females who would run for the, sit for the exam to become judges, they would fail. And I had lawyers who would tell me, I didn't make any mistake. I'm sure I should have passed. They didn't let anyone pass, it's only men. And then in 1996, by a political decision, the first woman passed the exam. Now we have around 300 female judges. We have one in the Court of Cassation. We have one who was head of the Judiciary Council, where they sit and have the exams. She headed the Judiciary Council for a while. So this is important. Now, recently, maybe the last 10 years, we have female criminal prosecutors. This was also a post that wasn't for women also. Now we have women who, you know, but not a lot compared to men, but there are women there. So this is important, of course, in the justice system. We don't have women in the Sharia courts. We have a woman recently, maybe 2 years or 3 years ago, who was appointed in the church. the church court, there was a woman appointed. We still do not have a woman in the constitutional court, but I mean, I'm sure one day we will have, because there's a lot of things that have changed. Now, in 1996, because as I told you, there was no place for women to go. If a woman is raped, they didn't know how to deal with her. And I'm sure it's the same here. In the past, I read that police would tell her, you know, it's your fault or not a big deal, you were raped or whatever. So in 1996, they established the Family Protection Unit. It was a unit in the beginning to deal with women who are raped, with children, child abuse, child molestation. And but then later on, they stopped receiving women for a while because they said their claim was that, you know, there was no place to, if a woman's life is in danger, where can we take her? Eventually, things changed. It later changed to the Family and Juvenile Protection Department. And there is a department in each of the 12 governorates now. And everybody knows about them. Like I write court verdicts, and if there's a case of molestation, it's I always read the family, oh, somebody got molested, and informed their family, and the family went and filed a complaint at the protection department. And this is important. They went to schools and everywhere to talk to children, you know, about molestation and so forth, and the need to report it. Now, in 1999, the Jordanian Women's Union opened the first shelter. Of course, in the mid-90s, we urged the government as activists to open a shelter for women. They refused. There was a funding of 1 million that was going to be given by UNDP, I think. And the Minister of Social Development back then, she was a woman. She said, no, I'm not going to open this shelter. They're going to say, I opened the shelter. That's for prostitutes and so forth. So they missed that opportunity. Then the women's movement opened a small shelter. It could house back then 12 women with their children. So this was important. This was the first time we became acknowledged, known that, oh, we have shelters now in Jordan. At least women would not go back to their abusers. This was very important. Now, in 1999, it was the establishment of, I told you, the group of young men and women, the Jordanian National Committee to Eliminate So-Called Honor Crimes. We also prepared this document. This document, basically, it has names, ages, and year. The names, ages, and years of women who were killed for reasons related to family honor. And they all collected it from all the stories I reported. And we had one part, this side, the names, and the other side, some information about the laws that we wanted to change. And we would go and distribute it everywhere. This was big back then, of course, because back then it was, I wouldn't say illegal, but you know, if you distribute pamphlets without authorization, you could get in trouble. We didn't care. We were distributing. We were going out in streets and so forth. So in 1999, when King Abdullah became king, one of the first things is he held a meeting with the women's movement to hear about their demands. And this was important, to be honest, you know, because during King Hussein's time, he didn't meet with women. Now King Abdullah came, he was young. So it was important that we see he's reaching out, trying to see what people want, what demands. I'm talking about women. He reached out to many people also, not only, but I mean, it was important for the women's movement. Now, as I said, because of the hotlines, because of the Jordanian women's shelter, because of the police department, they started to realize, no, we have a problem. We have to deal with the family. We have issues. We cannot keep hiding ourselves and saying, oh, we don't have, putting our head in the sand, saying we don't have anything. So the Queen, Queen Rania, held a meeting with the specialists to talk about this issue. And a year later, they established the National Council for Family Affairs, which is now also dealing with cases of violence against women. So now we have many entities. Imagine from nothing in the mid-90s, there are organizations, be it government or non-governmental, that are being born and work. Now, there were three laws that had a lot of issues in Jordan back in the 90s and early 2000s. Khulu' law, which is the divorce law, and I'll explain to you. Before 2001, women in Jordan was impossible for them, and I think it's in the Arab world, even in Egypt, until they introduced the Khulu' law in Egypt. Women were finding it very hard to divorce their husbands. The Sharia law would not allow it. You know, even if she's beaten and everything, it was impossible for her to. So there were a lot of cases, of hard cases, of whereby women could not, you know, and then the man would beat up his wife, or he would marry a second wife, and she cannot, she's stuck with him, you know. So there were a lot of humanitarian and hard cases. And the women's movement kept pushing for that. So they introduced a law that is the Khulu' law, which is based on a story that happened with the Prophet, peace be upon him. A woman came to divorce her husband. He said, okay, if you want to divorce his husband, give him back the garden he gave you and I will divorce you. So the women's movement relied on that. Okay, hey, wait. We have a story here that happened, so let's use that. And they changed it. But it was a big, big hassle and battle in the parliament. And everything is in the book. You can read about it, who's against it, who's with it. That's the Khulu' law. Then we have raising the age of marriage from 15 to 18. This was also a big deal. You know, no, we want to keep it 15. Once the girl reaches puberty, then she should get married, blah, blah, blah. Eventually, they raised the age, but still they put exceptions. So, and the exceptions, they still, women married for these exceptions. But now, before, it used to be like if there were 70,000 marriages a year, 10,000 would be the exceptions. Now it's 6,000. And now they're putting more restrictions and more monitoring. But I mean, it's still a problem. Amending Article 340 of the Jain Penal Code, which I told you, the article that offers leniency to killers, they amended that article. It wasn't the right article, but it was okay. It's one of the articles, so they amended that article. But there was a big battle in the parliament. It was and there was the women from the Islamic Action Front were against us, and everyone. It was a big, big battle, and they were like, you know, you want to destroy the morals of the society, you want to destroy us, you want to cancel Article 340, so women would go out and sleep with whoever they want. It was really a circus, you know. It was, and it's very sad because the parliamentarians were basically accusing women of bad things. They're talking about their mothers, wives, sisters, daughters, you know. It was really bad back then. It's a battle. And so they were changed in a temporary law. The parliament didn't vote. They waited until the parliament was not in session. There was no parliament. And they passed many temporary laws, and these were part of them. Later on, they became part of the law, but it was a battle of around 20 years. Now, in 2000, there was an important thing, and now since I'm in the UK, I can tell you, it's a UK project, because it's always, you know, whatever I lecture, it's not in the UK. So they had a five-year project whereby they trained judges, criminal prosecutors, forensics, everyone working in the family domain and the health sector on how to deal with victims, how to deal with victims of rape, how to deal with the abuse, how to detect a murder. If someone comes and says, oh, it's an accident. No, you know, so this was very important because really this changed also the attitude of judges, criminal prosecutors on how they approached family affairs. They started to realize it's not something internal. No, it's our job. We are here to protect the family. We are here to interfere and protect and not to say, oh, it's a family issue. So this was a very important project that happened in Jordan. Now, in 2003, remember I told you, in 1993, Tujan Faisal won, the first woman in Jordan. After that, two elections after that, no woman won. She ran again. She lost because the government didn't like her. After that, no woman won until in 2003, they decided to introduce a quota for women. And we had six women, the women's movement, six seats. Women movement asked for 12, but they only, whatever we ask, it's always half. If I was back then older, I would say just ask for 30, they give us 15. Simple. Later, the seats were increased to 12, then 15, and now we have a new system. I will tell you more about it later. The quota reasons, as I said, in the past, you can only vote for one person. It's not like here, you have a party, you can vote. It's a system here that I can't understand myself, but anyway. So people would always prefer to vote for a man or of their choice. Of course, we had a problem that women did not support women. They also prefer to vote for someone from their family. Women do not have money like men. That's a problem until this day, and I think it's worldwide. It's not only for women. And as I said, you know, they expect from male representatives to do things for them women cannot do. So these were the reasons. This is something I always like to highlight, which is football, because I think it's very important. I was in the Jordan Football Federation. Prince Ali brought me from 2009 until 2018. And I didn't put this here because I was, you know, in the Federation, but I put it because I think it was very important that the program started before I came to the Federation. But the Prince brought me to push it forward as an activist, as a feminist, and so forth. But because I believe that football breaks a lot of social taboos, breaks a lot of, even in the world until this day, you know, men think, oh, women shouldn't play football. So imagine in the Middle East. Now we started with few teams. Now we have ages like under 19, under 17, the national team, we have clubs. And now some players, they go, and some of them are playing in Saudi Arabia. You know, in Saudi Arabia now they have football. In the United Arab Emirates, so now they're trying to spread the game of football worldwide. And the thing about football, I'm sure you all know, is that anyone can play football. For example, I played basketball. It was mostly the middle class where you can buy a shoes, you can get a shirt, you can, if the federation doesn't give you. But here, you know, it's anyone plays football, because the poor, the rich. So we had all kinds of women, all kinds of backgrounds. You know, I would go I used to go and head delegations and, you know, go with my team in the bus, and I would see women from all sectors, women with fully covered, who would come and say bye to their daughters, to people just, without headscarves or anything. So it was a mix-up, Christians, Muslim. So this was very important because it's a mixture of cultures, mixture of classes, and they played football, and it was women playing football. So this was very important. So remember I told you we were asking for a shelter in the 90s. It took them until 2007, so around 10 years, to open the first government-run shelter. And even when they opened the shelter, they were afraid from the word shelter. So they changed it to the Family Reconciliation Center, which is okay, as long as they open the shelter. It's open, it's working. In 2008, the Family Protection Law was passed. Of course, in the penal code, I'm sorry, it doesn't handle a lot of cases related to family violence. So they introduced this Family Protection Law, but unfortunately, it's not applied strongly. Still, getting there. 2008, we are 2025. We get there. In 2008, the appointment of the first female governor in Jordan. It was important also we have a female governor, first time. Between 2007 and 2009, Jordan married non-Jordanians and their families, organized multiple movements to demand citizenship rights. The one here on top is, she's died unfortunately of cancer, but she was the leader of this movement. You know, Jordanian women married to non-Jordanians cannot pass on the citizenship to their husbands or children. And this has been a dilemma for the longest time, because they were treated as you know, foreigners. They had to go and register every year. They had to pay residency. They couldn't get a license, driver license. They couldn't enroll in. So this was a dilemma for the longest time. But things later on changed. We'll talk about it later. But I wanted to point it out because this is very important. The citizenship right is very important. Now we go to the 2010s. The so-called Arab Spring, I think, affected the entire Arab world. The women's movement, unfortunately, the women's demands were pushed back. Now it's more about safety, security. I want to save my regime. I want to save my country. I want to maintain stability and security. So for a while, they were affected. Nevertheless, the king and the queen met with women's leaders, which is also, again, a big deal because, as I said before that, the leadership didn't meet with the women movement, so this is important. Women's groups also were heavily involved, along with international organizations and the government, in helping the Syrian refugees when they came to Jordan. They immediately jumped in, offering their services, legal aid, all kinds of. Until this day, there's women's groups, women's NGOs. They have places in the refugee camps to help women refugees and children refugees. On all aspects, in addition to, of course, UNRWA, UNHCR, all these, you know, they have, and the government of Jordan did a lot for refugees. So there was, but you know, it's a big number, and there's a lot of things to do. So yeah, this was very important. Now in 2014, the government, after in 2007 when this woman opened, by the way, that woman opened a Facebook page to demand citizenship rights. They closed it. Somebody closed it. She opened another one. They closed it. She opened another one. Anyway, it took them until 2014 to finally, the government gave them privileges. Not citizenship. Until now, they can't have a citizenship. But privileges, you know, you can have a driver's license, you can own blah, 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 you know, all these privileges. And of course, it wasn't applied immediately. It took another 2 years. The government entities didn't recognize it, even if the government. It took a while, but eventually now it's different. In 2015, the government formed the Interministerial Committee for Women Empowerment. So this is very important also. They do all kinds of activities for women. See, there's more and more entities doing all kinds of things for women. In 2015, the election law was amended to have 15 seats. And in that year, or the year after, when the elections happened, 20 women won, not 15. There were five women who won outside the quota because the society became more, now is becoming more convinced of women's performance in the parliament. Now, in 2017, the parliament voted to cancel Article 308 and amend Article 98. 308 used to offer pardon for a person who sexually assault a teenager or a woman. If the person marries his victim, then there is no punishment. And this was also in other countries in the region. So this was a big problem, and the women's movement have been calling for that for 20 years to cancel this article. Finally, it was canceled because it's a big problem for women. How can you marry your rapist? You know, how can you marry? So this was canceled. Article 98 used to offer leniency to persons who killed their female relatives in the name of family honor. This was also amended, whereby now they cannot benefit from any reduction in penalty. Of course, there was a lot of the judiciary also has dealt with this issue seriously, starting in mid-2000. The judiciary also, the courts also started to pass on more tough punishments, but now it's on paper. So this was very important. In 2018, Prime Minister Omar Razzaz appointed seven women. It was the first time in the kingdom's history we have seven females in the cabinet. This was a big deal. I think in the UK, it's normal for you, right? In 2023, Prime Minister Bashir Fasawne also appointed seven, the second minister to appoint. So this is important when you have a lot of women in the cabinet. Now, the so-called honor killings. If we, you know what the so-called honor killing, right? Do I need to tell you? Okay, if a female's life is in danger, the government used to put them in prison to protect them. If a woman is, they try to kill her, she survives, she goes to prison. If a woman decides to leave the house, now not all women, I'm talking certain class, certain background. She leaves the house and she is caught, they put her in prison so the family would not kill her. So there have been women there spending 10, 12 years wasting their young life, their life behind bars without any charge, and they cannot release themselves because the government wants to protect them. Of course, when in the mid-90s we were calling for a shelter, the word shelter, that is a taboo, they didn't open the shelter. The shelter's idea was to include these women. When they opened the family reconciliation house in 2007, they didn't include these women. So these women stayed in prison until we had a female minister who is in the middle, Hala Latouf, who opened the first shelter for women. This was very important because now women are no longer staying in prison. They are, putting them in this shelter. It's a different lifestyle. They don't mix up with prisoners. They wake up whenever they want. It's like a safe house. You know what a safe house. So this is very important. In 2019, we had the first woman who's director of legislation on opinion bureau at the Prime Ministry. This is very important because this bureau is where all the laws that comes, the government wants to change a law and then take it to the parliament, it goes through this woman. So this is also a very important post for women back then. Yeah, I mean, it was also, you see, there's more women assuming things in Jordan. Now, in the 2020s, The parliament passed amendments to the Jordanian constitution, adding the word Jordanian men and women to the title of the second chapter. Before that, it was only men. And the women's movement said, please, let's add the word sex so that you would say, okay, the constitution is for all. They kept saying, no, 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 no. Eventually, they added this. But so far, we don't know the effects. Is it going to work? What is it going to reflect? But at least it was added again on paper. Of course, in 2023, the women's movement was very active in doing all kinds of activities in terms of collecting donations. Everyone in Jordan, but I'm talking about the women's movement in specific, doing activities, collecting money, donations for people in Gaza, and talking about the atrocities of the war. Again, as I said, I told you about the elections. Now they changed the elections law. They put a lot of conditions, such as the political parties, they have to have at least 20% members, women, female members. They were calling for inclusion. They changed the whole structure of election, which resulted in 27 women winning, which is very important, including 18 via quota. So this is important. Now you see there's from nothing to one, nothing, 6, 12, 15, 20, 27. So this is very important. I mean, to have women in the parliament, this is very important. And just before I came here, I think two weeks ago, the government introduced the strategy, social protection strategy. This is very important because this is going to cover everything related to anything related to the well-being of people, the violence. So now it's becoming a big thing, and the government is becoming more involved. You know, when I was working, one of my main aims back then was to have the government acknowledge that we have a problem in so-called honor killings, and the government wouldn't acknowledge. Eventually, it took them 10 to 15 years to acknowledge that we have a problem. And when the government acknowledges there's a problem, it becomes their responsibility to safely find measures to secure the safety and security of its citizens and women and children in Jordan. There are some challenges, of course, still the citizenship rights, the women's movement is constantly attacked, there's restrictions on NGOs, there's lack of funding, lack of unity among the women's movement. But as I always say to everyone, I never thought that a lot of these things would change during my lifetime. Thank you.
In your lifetime, you've really witnessed a revolution.
Yes.
And you've been a part of that revolution by bringing the focus to the issues that most harm the interests of women. You had to start with the most basic of gaining respect in the law.
Exactly.
And then to try and get political voice. But I'd like to focus, I'll take the first couple of questions and open it up to the floor, on the evolution that you describe in women's role, not just in voting, but in running for parliament. You start with Toujane El Faisal.
Yes.
So Toujane was a very flamboyant political figure.
She's a liberal woman. She's a journalist, by the way.
Some of the best people are.
Yeah.
Was Toujane, as the first woman elected to parliament, a positive development or a negative one? I'm thinking about the publicity, the battles with,
Al-Abadi,
Ahmed Awad Al-Abadi.
Yeah, no, there was one before. There was one when she the first went to the parliament. There was a deputy who told her, oh, if you wear the Islamic dress, I will give you 10 robes or something. And she slammed him, of course. She told him, I don't interfere in your what you wear. Why are you interfering in my what I wear? And of course, she did. She faced a lot of resistance. She was the only woman with 79 males. Imagine how hard it is for her to be among these people. She did fight for women's rights, but not, you know, she was fighting for national issues, for political issues. But she was a fighter for women's rights as well, and I do respect her for that. But imagine, put yourself back then, it was, you know, the first woman, it was always impossible to see a woman in the parliament. So all eyes were on her. Mm. For me, I think she had an important and successful experience. because she, you know, she was fighting for the right things and she was respected by people. But later on, I think later on she put herself in trouble. Some people said she shouldn't have, and some people said no. She's, for me, I find her a hero. For me, she's my hero.
Then we're going to leave her on a pedestal as a hero. But we note that when she finished her term in office, it was a while before women got elected to Parliament again. And when women returned to Parliament, it's after the imposition of a quota.
Yes.
So my question is, the quota was controversial.
Yeah, of course.
And many people argue that a quota is the wrong way for women to enter politics. But maybe in Jordan at that moment, it was a necessary stage. So could you tell us how the response to the introduction of a quota changed
women's roles? People were divided, but I think the women's movement called for the quota, and we wanted a temporary quota. It wasn't like we knew, the women's movement knew that it's not the solution, because it might bring someone who's against women. Mm-hmm. And that's what happened. Mm-hmm. That's what happened. Because when they voted for the three laws I showed you, the khulu, the age, and the Article 340, of course, in addition to the chaos in the parliament, there were six women, okay? Two of them were affiliated to Islamic Action Front. Mm-hmm. And there were four others, okay? Mm-hmm. Anyway, when the decisive session, because they voted against, it went to the Senate. The Senate said, no, we want these articles. Mm-hmm. It went back to the parliament. Mm-hmm. And in the decisive session, these two women from the Islamic Action Front voted against the laws. There were two women present, and two women didn't show up. And the law fell by five. So if these women voted for, and the other two women showed up, it would, or something, they would have passed. So they it was the difference. They made the difference, and the vote, the law didn't pass. It passed later on as a temporary law, as I told you, after the parliament was dissolved. And they were always, they're always against against anything related to women and children. That's, and they're always skeptical. They, I was accused by them. Now I see them, I say hi and everything. But they accused me personally of being, you know, a Western agent, you know, that, you know, we're doing something against traditions, and there's nothing against traditions and norms. Don't tell me no religion in the world says go and kill. No religion, you know.
We're going to come back to that, okay. But I want to say the issue about the empowerment of women in parliament,
yes,
and the role of quotas on that. And my last question on that is, the development you tell us is that actually women begin to get elected above and beyond the quota.
Yes. Yes.
Which seems to suggest that the acceptance of women's place in public life and political life was a frontier that was crossed.
Yes,
and that now the logic is a good candidate is elected,
yes,
male or female.
Yes.
Is that true?
Well, you see, the thing is that there's always this, the eyes are on women, you know. But then there are men who are not also very active, or, you know, they don't do anything. Some of them sit in the parliament, do not nothing. But the eyes are always on women, unfortunately. We also had women who, as I said, against women's rights. There are women who didn't do anything, but there are women who were very vocal. Other than Tujan Faisal, there were other women. One of them now, she's the Minister of Social Development. She was very, Wafa Bani Mustafa, she was very, very vocal. She's a lawyer. She knew her, what she was doing. She knew everything. She's smart. She fought for many things inside the parliament. She was vocal. Unfortunately, we lost her as an MP, but she's a social development minister, and she's doing also a lot of good things for women and children and for the society. So there are some who are really good, just like men. You have some who are good,
really?
Who are always, yeah, who's always, you know, and there are some who's just sitting there doing nothing. You know, it's all over the parliament. And some of them are sleeping. You see them everywhere in the world. You see MPs sleeping, you see, I mean...
But I want reason for optimism. And the thing I take away from your lecture, I know your lecture told me a story,
yes,
about how women transcended a barrier and are getting more and more successful.
Yes.
Is that a fair assessment, or
yes,
am I making a Hollywood happy
ending? There is a lot of other things that I didn't mention, because for example, we have women directing the traffic, female officers. Before, now it's been 20 years or so. Before, no way on earth, no way. They started with one or two. We have now female the traffic officers on motorcycles. Yes, no way before. In the army, we have females who fly F-16 or whatever now,
no
the flights, the planes
really?
Are. Yes,
Amazing.
I was going to put them into the presentation, but I didn't want to bore you with all these. I mean, these are like still small things, but they're very important.
Yeah, of course. Rana, we've run out of time.
Did we?
This is going to happen. I can only say that you have brought such knowledge to your audience as you have glory to the Devaki Jain lecture series.
My pleasure.
By what you shared with us today and what you've done in the books that you have written. So it only remains for you to join me in expressing our warmest thanks to Rana Hassani.
Thank you.
And to thank our guests who've been following online.
Thanks.
Good night and thank you.